This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our President's Day episode now with a look at the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. 2020 marks the 100th year that women have voted for president in the United States. Author Dr. Johanna Newman has a new book called And Yet They Persisted. It profiles not only the past 100 years of women's suffrage, but the long fight that led up to earning and winning that right. Dr. Newman joined me in this pre-recorded interview. And joining me now is the author of And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. The author is Johanna Newman. Johanna, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
So I'm looking at this title, and I'm making an assumption, I suppose. This is a reference to Senator Mitch McConnell's infamous line about Senator Elizabeth Warren during her objections to the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions as U.S. Attorney General, when McConnell famously said, nevertheless, she persisted. Is that right?
Well, I suppose it is. I was looking for a title that would also convey the extraordinary persistence of the women who led this movement. You know, if I can say, most histories of women's suffrage begin in 1848. When Elizabeth Cady Stanton stood up at Seneca Falls and suggested that women have the right to vote. And they end in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was enacted and ratified. But when Wiley approached me, the publisher, and asked me to do a comprehensive history, I said, you know, we really have to go back to the colonies. When there was agitation for women, by women, for the vote, including Abigail Adams.
I read about Abigail Adams in this book, and I was really surprised by the exchange she had
with her husband.
So it was really surprising to read John Adams. I guess they had, I don't know if this was just quoted from them being in person. Was this, it escapes my memory now.
No, letters.
Letters, yeah, okay, so it's documented. And, you know, when I think about women's suffrage, I've got that image of, you know, Victorian era fashion and those more 20th century images. But to go back to 1776, tell us what went down between the Adams and their home, or between them and their correspondence.
Can you imagine the pillow talk that evening after Abigail wrote? John Adams was setting off for the Second Continental Congress. And it's there that the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union were adopted to set laws for these 13 disparate colonies on how they would manage, how their relations would work with one another. And she wrote to him and she said, remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husband. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. And she also said, if particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. And John Adams replied, I think about 2 weeks later, as to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh. Depend on it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. So there was this agitation for the vote in the air with the first stirrings of revolutionary fervor. And then it seemed to me you had to take this history well beyond 1920. I mean, we are celebrating the centennial of that remarkable event this year. But you have to take it to the civil rights era, when African American women in the South, technically enfranchised by the 19th Amendment, were denied their rights to vote by local Jim Crow laws that imposed, you know, arduous hardships toward the ballot.
And I definitely want to talk about some of the more modern disenfranchisement that has been experienced by voters in America. But if we could just hang out in the 19th century a little bit longer.
If I could just add, in answer to your question, this is why the title, because it seems to me that it was two centuries, eight generations of women. And I don't know a better definition of persistence. So, yes, when I heard that line that McConnell used toward Elizabeth Warren, I thought, you know, there's something there.
And additionally, back in 1776, while the Adams were privately feuding with each other, John Adams held some pretty harsh views about voting in general. I saw in your book his response to a member of the Massachusetts General Court expressing his opposition not only to women voting, but, you know, youth, teenagers, suggesting that they might have rights in this country. For people without wealth, suggesting that they should be treated equally as well.
Yeah, imagine. I think Adams was more prescient than some of the other founders about the potential impact of all this revolutionary rhetoric. I mean, there was all this talk in the air of divorcing the tyrant in Britain, you know, leaving the king, self-empowerment. And I think Adams saw that if they opened the door a little bit to female enfranchisement or black enfranchisement, that all these groups would rush in, which in fact, of course, they have. And it's the wondrous thing about our system that they did.
And it seems that, as documented in your book, that sometimes the progress is reserved for one disenfranchised group, not necessarily at the expense of another, but certainly to the delay of another's. You write about how in the years following the Civil War, the nation was putting itself back together. You've got this comment from Wendell Phillips, who I guess was known as the abolitionist golden trumpet, as you write. He said basically that as former slave men got the right to vote, but not women, he said causes have their crises, and that of the Negro has come, that of the women's right movement has not yet come. Tell us about that.
It's all true. It's beautiful rhetoric. In fact, what had happened in Congress is that Republicans who were leading this effort toward, you know, opening the electorate doors, they lost seats, and they no longer had the sort of vibrant majority that would allow them to do both. And so that's one piece. The other piece is, I think, genuinely, for abolitionists who had been campaigning for over 30 years to end slavery, this was a remarkable moment in history. It was their signature that they won this cause, and this is the cause they wanted to celebrate and honor. And I also think, on some level, and I don't know this, but you might imagine that men were more comfortable enfranchising other men, even if they were of a different class, as in the case of the white men who were enfranchised under Andrew Jackson in the 1830s, who didn't have property. Property had always been the marker for suffrage. Suddenly, Andrew Jackson opens the electorate to white men who do not have it. And then after the Civil War, lawmakers open it to black men without property. And so I just wonder if there's a comfort level with men that isn't there with women, and that maybe that's why it takes longer for women to claim their vote.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our guest today is author Johanna Newman, whose new book is called And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. We're having this conversation in the year that we recognize 100 years, the centennial of women's suffrage in America. And since we're talking to you from Cincinnati, I want to try to localize your book a little bit. There's sort of a connection. And as you know, there's a name that deeply resonates here in the Queen City, Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, her famous house here. I learned something from your book involving Harriet's sister, Catherine Beecher as it relates to Native Americans, and I'm hoping you can tell our listeners about her and why she became active in politics.
Well, I love this story. Thank you for asking about it. One of the reasons I love this story is that during the Revolution, many women were actively involved. They were supporting the boycotts, the British boycotts, by spinning their own material and making their own herbal teas and not importing things. Some of them disguised themselves as men and served in the army. Others served the troops by cleaning and cooking. But after the war, there's this what one historian has called this revolutionary backlash. And women are told to go back into the homes to resume their domestic duties. They are not creatures of the public square. Politics is not their domain. And they are given the task of educating the next generation, of raising up the new patriots of this new republic. And one of the things that happens is that women say, if you want us to educate the next generation, you have to let us get educated. And so all of these seminaries and academies for girls start to blossom. One of them is run by Catherine Beecher. And she is Jeremiah, whose last name I'm forgetting, but she is lobbied for a cause to fight against Andrew Jackson's policy called the Indian Removal Policy. This is the exodus, the forced exodus of Cherokee and other tribes from their lands to Oklahoma. And historians call it the Long Trail of Tears. And it stirred passion in Catherine Beecher, and women were not supposed to participate. They were not supposed to appeal to Congress. But she started a stealth lobby of women all over the country. She wrote an appeal to women talking about their responsibility to stand up against this policy. This was wrong, and Congress should not approve it. And all of a sudden, petitions start raining down on Congress. She said that it was exhausting to maintain her anonymity. And years later, in her memoirs, she talked about how difficult it was, what a strain it put on her for having to keep a secret that she was the author of this brilliant missive that rallied women. And I have it in the book because I think it's the first political act of American women after the Revolution.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
And it's all part of Johanna Newman's new book, And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. Before I let you go in our last 30 seconds together, Johanna, which woman from this book do you think Americans or the average reader will be surprised to learn about?
I think the black women who rose up in the civil rights era to say enough. We deserve our rights. You know, we hear a lot about the black men who led that movement, Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson Jr., and well, we should. They did remarkable, brave things. But the black women were the ones that galvanized the grassroots to come out and support them. And as Fannie Lou Hamer said, we were just sick and tired of being sick and tired. And she also said, poignantly, nobody's free until everybody's free. And those women really stole my heart.
The name of the book is And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. The author is Johanna Newman. She's been our guest today. Johanna, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.